runt. Is you there, runt, or he's coming to eat you? You runty little scrum screwer, piffling little fish figgler, prunty little pug's vizzler. I'm going to winkle you out, you tasteful human being. Sophie was terrified. Of course, you'll recognise the words from... it's the stuff of nightmares. It is, of course, a very clever way of engaging children with their fears, this thought of monsters walking around. It is the stuff of nightmares, isn't it? There are monsters going around. You can blow scary dreams into your brain. Plays on all of our fears. You can be frightened of all kinds of things, can't you? Pognophobia, for example, which is fear of... beards, very good. Bathmophobia, fear of baths. No, it's going to be more subtle than that, isn't it? Stairs. Bogeyphobia. Careful. It's not the obvious one. Bogeymen. Fears that are really scary. And we joke about those fears, but all of us know the fears that you have in nightmares. Those fears that you face in a dream and you wake up from, and I don't know whether you have this, you can't quite remember the thing that you're frightened of, but you still feel the fear afterwards. And you're trying to remember, what was the thing I was just dreaming about I was so scared of? It can be the fear of the dark, the room full of rats or spiders, the being at some great height, whatever it is that is the thing that ignites that panic inside you, that irrational fear that we experience in dreams where you can't grab a hand, or you run but you're not able to get away, or that the dog is always following you or whatever. As Christians, we may know that God is in charge, but when our fears loom large, sometimes, often, it doesn't feel as if God is in charge. Sometimes when we are really frightened, it does feel as if monsters are in charge. Sorry. Yes, not Boris. And I'm not talking about, you know, the BFG literally walking around the city. I mean, not real monsters. That would be frankly ridiculous, wouldn't it? I mean, the city. But we watch the news. We see another suicide bomb and the mayhem that results. Or there's an election that gives power where we fear how that power might be used. Or there's war, or the rumours of war, or battleships being deployed to a particular bit of the world. Or migrants who are on the run trying to escape the horror of their homes being bombed. There's a change of government. There's a new prime minister. Or the thought of another 4 years of the same Mr. President. And we know that despite all of the promises and the hopes and the, we're going to make Britain great again, this is a start of a golden era, even powerful governments are impotent. Ronald Reagan said, governments don't solve problems, they merely rearrange them. The next cycle, 4 or 5 years' time, will we have stopped the monstrosities? No, I guess the news will be much the same. It will still feel as if monsters are roaming the world and are in charge. Or we bring it much closer to home, and somebody that we love very much dies, and everything feels bad. Or there's some terribly hard thing in our family when things go terribly wrong. Or there's an illness, or results of tests, or depression, or childlessness, or old age, or you lose your job, or you fall out with your best friend. Something bad invades your home, your life, that disrupts your carefully made plans of what your life is supposed to pan out like. And at that moment, it can feel kind of as if you just have no control. You are just subject to these forces. It feels as if monsters are in charge. Now, that is just how it felt to Daniel and to his people. We're thinking yesterday, weren't we, of how Daniel is a tale of two cities, that Jerusalem has been taken to Babylon. The southern half of the nation of Israel, centered on its capital center, a city of Jerusalem, has been threatened by the big bad bully Babylon, taken them into exile. The land's been invaded. The best people have been carried off, including Daniel, this teenager, this undergrad student. And later, all the people are going to be deported. The city is going to be destroyed. Daniel is crisis literature. It's 999 literature. Daniel is all about living in a world where it feels like monsters are in charge. And we are just subject to what they do to us. We're the little people. So a tale of two cities. Today I want us to think about Daniel as a tale of two realities. There is, first of all, the what you see is what you get reality. In other words, look out of your window and describe what you see. That, of course, is real. That is reality. But there is another reality as well, another way of describing it, another way of looking at it. There is a heavenly view on it that describes other things that are going on behind the scenes in the heavenlies. Things that we can't see, but they are just as real. Do you remember that moment when Jesus was completely changed in front of three of disciples, the mountain of transfiguration? And remember, three of Jesus' disciples were given a glimpse, a sneak look behind the curtain. And they get to see that it's not the Wizard of Oz, some wimpy anticlimax, as we were thinking about yesterday, but they get to see what Jesus is really like. Jesus in all his glory. Something that you couldn't see, not normally as they were living alongside Jesus, walking around next to him. They couldn't see these things, not unless somebody revealed those things to you. And in Mark chapter 9, that's exactly what God did. God drew back the curtain and let Peter, James, and John see, get a glimpse of, okay, this is the heavenly view of this Jesus, the glorious one, the one who is so bright you can't even look at him. Two realities then, what you can see and what we can't see unless it's shown to us. They're both real, but two realities. There was a workman who was leaving the factory after a day's work, and he was pushing a wheelbarrow as he left work, as he was coming out of the factory. And inside the wheelbarrow that he was pushing was a small box, small package, and inside this box, well, I'll tell you what was inside it in a minute. He's pushing the wheelbarrow with a box in it. He's stopped by the security guard at the entrance to the factory. And the security guard asks him, "What have you got in your wheelbarrow?" And the man says, "I've got a small package." Security guard says, "Yes, I can see it's a small package. What's inside it?" "Well," says the man, "you know, at the end of the day, all that sawdust that they sweep up on the floor at the end of the working day, it normally just gets swept up and thrown away. I needed some sawdust, so I'm taking some of it home." "Open the box," says the guard. So he opens the box. It's full of sawdust. "Okay, then, off you go." Second day, the same thing. Wheelbarrow, small box, open the box, sawdust. Third day, the same thing. Fourth day, and so on. It gets to the fifth day, Friday. He's on his way out of the wheelbarrow of the factory, pushing the wheelbarrow with the small box inside it. Same security guard. "Oh, it's you again," he says. "What have you got in your wheelbarrow?" "Same as all the other 4 days, small package with sawdust inside." "Well, open it up." He opens it up. It's full of sawdust. "Look," says the security guard, "I've got this feeling that something's going on here. You're trying to steal something from the factory. Why don't you tell me what you're stealing, and I promise I won't report you. I won't do anything about it." "Okay," says the guy. "I'm stealing wheelbarrows." Now that is what is going on in Daniel-ish. So in Daniel, you've got this constant interplay between two realities. The world all around us, what is very obvious to us, what we experience and touch and feel, what everybody can see, it's very real to us. But there is also another parallel reality, what you wouldn't know by looking, what you can't possibly see unless somebody draws back the curtain and points it out to you. We've got to be told about it. Now, just because we can't see it doesn't mean it's not real. It's very real. They're both realities. There is the wheelbarrow as well as the sawdust. What everybody can see and is obvious, and the thing that you wouldn't notice unless somebody tells you. Now, come back to the first couple of verses of Daniel, and let me show you that that's exactly what those first two verses are like. We thought about this yesterday. So what are we told in the first two verses? Well, we're told the what you see is what you get reality that everybody could see. Jerusalem is overtaken by Babylon. God's people are defeated by the power of Babylon. If you were going to report that on the news, that's the story. But look at what verse 2 tells us, that you couldn't know just by looking, but is another reality that is just as true. And the other reality is that God gave Jehoiakim into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. No newspaper would report that as the story. We only know it because God tells us that's what's going on. He reveals this other reality that behind the troop movements on the ground, God gave Jehoiakim into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. The Lord did it. Now, which of those two realities is real in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 1? And the answer is both of them are real. They're both going on at the same time. Two realities alongside one another. Now, that, I think, is what all the dreams, that kind of weird stuff in Daniel is all about. That God is revealing to his people what you cannot see. What you wouldn't know, couldn't possibly fathom and guess at unless God reveals it to you. It is genuine, but God's got to reveal it to you for you to see this other reality. That's what all the monsters and the battles and the winning and the losing is all about. It's God showing his people, revealing to them and to us stuff that we couldn't know, we couldn't see, but it is very, very real. And we need to know it if we're going to work out how to live in this world. To live in the world of the reality that we can all see experience, holding on to the truth that God reveals, the other hidden reality. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 7 and see how this pans out in this chapter. So my first heading for this, we're going to come to it in a minute, is that God is going to end this world's monstrous kingdoms. But that's not how the chapter starts. The chapter is a dream, and in this dream, Daniel sees visions. And the vision he sees is of four monsters who are very much in charge. What are they like? Verse 4. The first is like a lion. It's got the wings of an eagle and it's got 2 feet like a man. The second monster, verse 5, it's like a bear with ribs between its teeth. The third monster, verse 6, well, it's like a leopard with 4 wings like a bird, with 4 heads. So not very like a leopard. And the fourth one, verse 7, what's that like? Well, it's like nothing. This one is a real monster. This is a teeth machine. This is all iron teeth. When Roald Dahl thought up the blood bottler and the flesh lump eater and the child chewer and the gizzard gulper, I only put all those names in because I like trying to say them. When Roald Dahl thought them up, they weren't nearly as frightening as these guys. These guys, these things, these monsters, these terrifying beings coming up out of the sea, the primeval foe. Probably there are 4 of them to represent the totality of this threat. All the forces of chaos. 4 great empires. 4 powerful states. But bestial. Semi-human in the way they operate. And of course, if you try to draw them, as, bless him, this person has done, you know, they do look ridiculous, don't they? I mean, it lessens them. The whole point is, of course, they are terrifying. They are not drawn but described in a way that makes them absolutely frightening. And the point is, they are everybody's worst nightmares. Let me just put it this way. You wouldn't choose to meet any one of these four in a dark lane on a February evening, would you? See where they come from, verse 3? They come up out of the sea. That's the place in the Bible that represents everything that's opposed to God. See what they're like, verse 7? They are exceedingly strong. I don't know why the word exceedingly always makes me think of Mr. Kipling, but these are exceedingly strong. And second half of verse 7, they are stamping over everything. It's that one word, that imagery, just stamping over everything. Such awful things had happened to Daniel and his friends. It felt like monsters like this were in charge of the world. They're experiencing an unprecedented level of pressure. Various kings and their kingdoms, rulers whose power felt, well, monstrous, unstoppable, like an iron teeth machine. That's what that fourth monster is like. I don't know if you are one of those geeky people who ever watch Robot Wars, but this is like one of the house robots. That I picture number four as an enormous Matilda. If you've ever watched Robot Wars, you think what I mean. And if you haven't, that illusion was entirely lost on you. Matilda. Nothing to do with Roald Dahl, different Matilda. And all of us feel the world is like this sometimes, where your experience of the world feels like there are monstrous forces who are just running the show, and you're some little victim, a nobody, who's being stamped on. The Bible says the world will feel more like this for Christians. Things are going to get worse. It won't feel as if God is in charge at all. It will feel as if we are entirely in a world run by monsters. Now, what do people like Daniel and his friends need? What do people like us need? Especially if we are feeling in any way vulnerable at this moment to forces like these monsters. Let me tell you, what we don't need is some post-truth pick-me-up. We don't need some flimsy, fluffy, oh, it'll be all right, don't you worry. We don't need wishful thinking, thank you very much. We don't need truthiness. What we need is true truth and real reality. That's the only thing that's going to be robust enough to help us live in a world under the control of monsters like this. Please will you tell me something that I can build my life on when I feel very vulnerable. And so God pulls back the curtain. So see what else Daniel is shown in this vision. He sees these four monsters, but also God reveals to him, verse 9, thrones set up. And somebody sitting on the throne. It's a courtroom scene. You'll see that's how it's described at the end of verse 10. So we've all seen enough crime dramas to know what a courtroom looks like. A year ago, I took my 17-year-old daughter to the Old Bailey, to the Public Gallery, to see the summing up of a case that involved a stabbing in Peckham, because Peckham is where we lived. And I thought, any responsible parent ought to take his 17-year-old daughter to hear a court case like that. So anyway, we have experienced what it is like to see that going on. Imagine that kind of scene and inflate it several billion times. Because that's the scene here of this courtroom. See what the throne is like in verse 9? It's a chair made of fire with wheels of fire. Can you picture that? It's pouring out fire like a volcano's molten lava. And you see that somebody's sitting on it in verse 9. You've got this? It's somebody sitting on fire. Got that picture? And the person, we are told, verse 9, is called the Ancient of Days. That's the person who is in this judge's chair, this judge's throne. And that is a title, presumably, for God himself. It's not a title that comes anywhere else in the Bible, the Ancient of Days. And nobody's quite sure what it means. But it is very suggestive, isn't it? Ancient, older than days. In other words, somebody who is supreme over time itself. Look at that thought. Somebody who's supreme over history. Older than time. Now, somebody like that, sitting on a throne that's on fire, that's somebody who's competent to judge. And at the end of verse 10, books are opened. Books that tell what everybody has done, that records the deeds, the actions, the web history. It's every bit of CCTV footage that's followed you around. Books are opened. My wife Lizzie is a teacher. When we were in Nottingham, we moved from Nottingham 3 years ago, but while we were in Nottingham, she was a full-time teacher in a school that she'd been working at for 6 years. When she arrived at the school, they were expecting their Ofsted inspection the next term. 6 years later, they were still waiting for that Ofsted inspection. It didn't happen during the whole of the 6 years. And if any of you have been involved in education, you know the tension that there is in the staff room when you're expecting the Ofsted inspection next term, that threat that's hanging there. You know, when they come, what will they make of our school? What will they say about my teaching? They've got the power to condemn our school and announce failing or put us in special measures, those terrible Damocles sword-like terms that hang as a threat over a school. The picture here is of a world where one day God is going to be like that feared school inspector who will examine the lesson plans of everybody's work, who will examine our performance. Everybody will have to explain what the books say, and he will give his verdict. Like an Ofsted inspection, hardly. Remember, this is the Ancient of Days sitting on fire. And so in this scene, these four monsters will be brought to account. However mighty and powerful this iron teeth machine, this Matilda, may seem, they are all going to have to stand before this greater power and authority. They will stand before the judge of all. The four monsters will have to own up, and so will everybody else. And God will decide what will happen to them and to every one of us. God decides. God is in charge. Is judge. God is in charge. These monsters will have their day. And in verse 11, the monsters are destroyed. Destroyed by fire, we're told. So in other words, fire that comes from the judge, presumably. He's the one who's on fire. It's his judgment. And at the moment when he burns them up, they will have to stop seeming to be in charge. And as the fire burns them up, everybody will see that God is the one on the throne. Now, this future matters. It's crucial for the people of God. Know your future. And part of that future is that God will end this world's monstrous kingdoms. And the second part of that future is what happens next. That God will establish Jesus as king forever. A man is brought in. Verse 13, he's called one like a son of man, which just means bloke. So a bloke is brought in. But remember, of course, son of man, that is Jesus' favorite title for himself. And when Jesus used that title, he was thinking of this passage. He was claiming to be the one that this passage is going to describe. Just keep a finger in Daniel 7 and flick over to Mark chapter 14. And let's see one of those places where Jesus uses this title to to describe himself. And as soon as you get to Mark 14, you look at where we are in the story. You'll see this is another trial scene. Once again, we have a judge's bench, and we have a prisoner in the dock. So let's pick it up in verse 60, where the high priest, who is here, the judge, on the judge's bench, he says to Jesus, who is the prisoner in the dock, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus in the dock remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest, the judge in this scene, asks the question, "Yeah, but are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you will see," here it comes, "you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." You see, the scene is you have a monstrous high priest in Mark 14, a religious authority behaving like a monster, the most shocking miscarriage of justice the world has ever seen. A man who is patently innocent. And he presses Jesus in the dock. And do you see what Jesus' reply is about this trial scene? Do you see what Jesus is saying in verse 62? "There will come a day when the tables will be turned. You will get up from the judge's seat, and I will get up from the dock, and we will swap places. I will be in the judge's chair, and you will be the prisoner in the dock. The Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of power alongside the Ancient of Days on his fiery throne, coming with the clouds of heaven." In other words, and that's just one of the many places we could turn to in the gospel, but in other words, what Jesus is saying is that this man who is brought in Daniel 7, let's come back there now, this man who is made king in Daniel 7, this is Jesus. This is the bloke who walks in. He is the one being established as king forever. He comes, verse 13, riding clouds like you might ride a Harley Davidson. He's given the world to rule, just like you might give somebody a bunch of flowers. And everybody has to admit, everybody has to confess with their lips, "You are the king." Obviously, totes obs. He sits while we do whatever he says, as if we're his manservant, we're his ever-attentive house cleaner. Look at how it is put in verse 14. "All peoples, nations, and languages will serve him." Of course. What else could you do with this Ancient of Days and this Son of Man riding clouds? So everybody's got to admit, has got to confess, "You are king." And all of this stretches far into the future, further ahead than we can see. God sets up a kingdom that's never going to be destroyed, where Jesus is never going to stop being king, and he's going to be king forever and forever and forever and forever. It's an extraordinary picture, isn't it? You may know those five questions that Tony Benn, the left-wing politician, said you've got to ask of any person in power. What power have you got? Where did you get it from? In whose interests do you exercise it? To whom are you accountable? How can we get rid of you? Apply those questions to Jesus, this person in power. What power have you got? Well, I've got all power, actually. That's what the verse says. Every single bit of it. Who gave it to you? Well, it was given to me by the Ancient of Days, the God of the universe, him who's sitting on the throne of fire. This Jesus is only accountable to God because he's the judge with the fiery throne. And of course, Jesus could never be deposed. Not ever. Who could destroy his kingdom? I mean, don't make me laugh. A And now comes the most extraordinary twist of the chapter. We get to these words of verse 14. We're told that Jesus' dominion will never pass away, that his kingdom is never going to fade away. And then, in this chapter, that's exactly what happens to Jesus. He fades away. The Son of Man isn't mentioned again from verse 15 onwards. And he's just not in another scene in this vision. And as if that isn't extraordinary enough, look down to three verses with me. Look down to verse 18. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. Look down to verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. And most extraordinary of all, verse 27. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. Now, those three verses would be fine if it was all about Jesus, wouldn't it? Kingdom, authority, power, dominion, all that given to Jesus. It's almost blasphemous to say, as these verses say, that it is given to who? You. Us. If we're Christians. Do you get the point here? Not only does Jesus win, but all his friends will be the winning side as well. When we first moved to London, we were at Grace Church Dulwich with Simon and Rachel Dowdy for a while, and there's a lovely old guy in that church there called Ken, who is a keen Crystal Palace supporter. He goes to watch their matches. He's every Sunday. That's wants to tell you how Palace did yesterday. Let me just put it this way so that Ken's football playing days are probably over. Imagine Ken is watching Crystal Palace. Palace are losing, and the other team's fans are letting you know. And then Palace pull one back. There's a cross, a flicked header, and it's 1-1. And then moments before the final whistle, a penalty is awarded. Palace scores. And Ken is on the winning side. Now, of course, Ken isn't actually, unlikely as it may seem, Ken isn't on the pitch playing for Palace. But boy, does he share in Palace's glory. He tells everybody on Sunday, you can't shut Ken up on a Sunday saying, we won! Now, that's the picture here. We are like Kens. And we share in the victory of our team, Jesus. The kingdom, the dominion, the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven, the whole caboodle is given to God's people. We won. As I come to an end, I want you to imagine how this would feel if you were with Daniel during this book. If you were in exile, you are under the kosh. You are in Babylon, far away from your homeland. We know exactly how the people felt there because they wrote some of it down in the Psalms. We were so upset we couldn't sing, we could only cry. We were mocked by our Babylonian captors who were saying, go on, sing us one of your happy little worship songs. But we couldn't. Says Psalm 137, we hung up our guitars. We couldn't sing a thing. Imagine that you feel the monstrous Nebuchadnezzar is absolutely being described by one of these four monsters, like the iron teeth flesh lump eater that he is, that he's strong and stamping all over you. What would you feel in that situation when Daniel said, I've got to tell you this reality that God has revealed to me? I've got to tell you about this vision. I've got to tell you about what God will do with all these monstrous empires. I've got to tell you about Jesus who is coming and what is promised to him and therefore what is promised to you guys here. This is what the future looks like for you. Monsters burnt up by fire, the Ancient of Days on the throne, providing judgment, giving the whole lot to Jesus, and Jesus shares it with you. I mean, wow. Now who is as powerful as jelly? But I want to think of a second line of application on this. Let's just go back a little bit into the story. So this is similar to the diagram I gave you yesterday of these two kingdoms, Israel in the north, Judah in the south, the way that Israel get taken into exile in Assyria, and Judah, which is the half of the kingdom we're thinking about, the southern half are ended up in Babylon. And you'll see that this is very like a table that you've got in your notes on page 15. So this is the kind of history. I gave you the geography version yesterday. This is the history version. I could keep doing this. I could keep doing different GCSE subject versions of the story. So this is where we are in the story. And the pink arrow here, this is the bit of the exile. This is the bit where Daniel lives. So the pink arrow is the period of history that the book of Daniel covers. And it's the period of history in which Daniel is living. But do you remember that verse at the end of Daniel chapter 1 with which we ended yesterday? Do you remember how it ended? We saw that as Daniel arrives in Babylon and makes the stand, I want to make it clear my loyalty to the Lord of Israel. We're told the very last verse of Daniel chapter 1 that Daniel remains there in Babylon until the first year of King Cyrus. All through the lifetime of Nebuchadnezzar, all through the lifetime of Nebuchadnezzar's son, until the next regime, Persia, comes along, wipes them away and takes control. The significant thing in this verse is the word Cyrus. Because Cyrus is the man who made the declaration that those who had come into exile with Daniel could go back. So Daniel chapter 1, verse 21, is 70 years after Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. Got 70 years covered in that chapter. Chapter 1 takes us from the beginning of the pink arrow to the end of the pink arrow. Cyrus is the one who says that the exiles can come back. Now, what that means is that the book of Daniel cannot be written until after that has happened. You can't put in chapter 1, verse 21 until you've actually had the reign of Cyrus start, the decree of Cyrus saying the exiles can go back, and the journey of the exiles back. In other words, Daniel is written for the people after the exile. Daniel happens during the pink arrow, but it is written for people after the pink arrow. In other words, it's written for people who have gone back to Jerusalem, come out of Babylon, and return to Jerusalem. And what the Bible tells us is that when they get to Jerusalem, it's quite disappointing to be back. It's not the wonderful new heaven and new earth that they were expecting God would provide for them. It wasn't that wonderful Jerusalem yet. So they discover themselves back in Jerusalem, the place on the map with the red dot and the name beginning with the capital J, but not yet in the heavenly home, the eternal Jerusalem that God intends for his people. So they're back in Jerusalem, but they're not yet in Jerusalem. Or to put it another way, they are no longer in exile, but they're still in exile. They're not in Babylon, but they're not yet back at their final heavenly home. And the significance of this is that the lessons of the exile in Babylon still apply all the time until we get to our heavenly home. Daniel is written for people not who are in Babylon, but who have returned to Jerusalem. To say, yes, you are back from Babylon, but you are not yet fully home. Daniel is written for people like us in our situation. Not yet in the Jerusalem that God has promised to us. So I said, first of all, imagine how you would feel as Daniel 7 is told to you, if you are in Babylon with Daniel. I want you to now imagine how Daniel chapter 7 feels if you are not in chains in exile anymore. For that matter, you could be sitting in Ashburnham in we Kent or Sussex here? Wherever we are. Is it Sussex? It's Sussex. Yeah. Imagine instead you're in a much better state. Imagine you're very like us, prosperous, relatively, comfortable, doing okay. Don't you think we need to be told Daniel chapter 7 too? Don't you think we need to be told, you do realize that you're promised the world, don't you? That's how the story ends. Daniel chapter 7, verse 27. The kingdom, the dominion, the greatness of the kingdoms and the whole heaven, they're going to be given to you. Goodness knows why we make such a big deal of a new car or a house extension or whether our kid has succeeded in their grade one violin. For goodness sake, you're going to be given the world like you give somebody a bunch of flowers. I mean, in the big scheme of things, in the light of the future that God reveals here, in the light of being given, verse 27, the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven, what are all those other trifling things that we play with in the mud? How dumb we are to make much of those gifts. We might not be in Babylon, but we are still in Babylon. We're not yet home. Look what is promised as to how the world ends. Monsters, schmonsters. Ancient of Days, a throne that's on fire. Jesus, given dominion and glory and kingdom. We're part of the winning team. Wow. Let's pray together. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Lord God, that is absolutely extraordinary. How incredible to think that what we willingly acknowledge should be given to Jesus, he shares with us. Extraordinary. And because we live in a world where things can very often feel monstrous and as if we are the little insignificant people that they're subject to horrible forces that are opposing us or make life feel chaotic, disordered. How fantastic is this picture of what it will be like to arrive home, to share in this forever and ever and ever. Forgive us, Lord, that we fiddle around with trinkets here. We so highly prize pathetic little toys. How glorious is this future that stretches into foreverness ahead of us. Thank you for what it is that you promise to people living in a world of monsters. Thank you for this kingdom given to Jesus and shared with us. We thank you so much. In Jesus' name, amen.